Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens:
a possible end in sight. Hamas responds to Donald Trump's ceasefire plan, agreeing to release all Israeli hostages and enter into negotiations, a scenario that just a few days ago seemed implausible to a lot of people, including our guest, former Middle East negotiator Aaron David Miller.
And street fight. Across Morocco, young people are making their dissatisfaction with the current regime heard. An activist tells us things must change and the protests will continue until they do.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Friday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, CBC program, here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Harmony Food Co-op, Bemidji's full-service downtown grocery store, offering people a variety of local, organic, fair trade, and conventional items. Open daily from 8 to 8. More at harmonyfoods.coop, also on Facebook. And we receive support from ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. KXE started without federal funding in 1976, and today, nearly 50 years later, we find ourselves in the same place again. It's a powerful reminder that this station has always been people-powered, and today, that need is even greater. Join us at kaxe.org. Now I'm going to play a song for you. This is Blood Orange with the song Vivid Light. That is Vivid Light by Blood Orange.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Terms and conditions. Hamas responds to the U.S. president's peace proposal and says it agrees to some aspects of it, including the release of all Israeli hostages.
Woman of the cloth. For the first time in more than a millennium, a woman will lead the Church of England. A London vicar says Sarah Mullally is the perfect person to heal a divided church.
A fight to the better end. Young people flood the streets of Morocco expressing their anger over health care, education and unemployment. And one activist tells us they will not stop until they see concrete action.
Wild swan chase. His soul is as dark as his feathers, and now a black swan nicknamed Mr. Terminator has been exiled from an English town after terrorizing the local swans, not to mention our guest who had to capture him.
Kicking up extinct, the owner of a New Jersey theme park is selling off his herd of animatronic dinosaurs, and like his Stegosaurus, interest is seeing some major spikes.
And hit me with your nest shot. New research has found that birds all over the world issue the same call, warning each other about cuckoos, which lay their eggs where they are not wanted. As It Happens, the Friday edition, radio that can't play you the whole warning call, just an excerpt. After days of uncertainty, Hamas has responded to Donald Trump's ceasefire plan. Earlier this week, the U.S. president unveiled his 20-point framework to end Israel's war in Gaza, which included installing himself as the head of an international transitional body that would run the territory. Israel had already signed on, and earlier today, President Trump said he was giving Hamas until Sunday to do the same, or, quote, all hell would break loose. Now Hamas has issued its response. It says it will release all Israeli hostages, dead and alive, and it signaled a readiness to immediately enter mediated negotiations to discuss details. Aaron David Miller is a former U.S. State Department Middle East negotiator. We reached him earlier today on the road near Moreland Hills, Ohio.
Aaron David Miller, do you see in this Hamas response any reason for Palestinians, people of Gaza, families of hostages still being held right now to be hopeful?
Not if Palestinian civilians, the hostages, and their families are expecting a quick, straight line end to the war, improvements, the end of the Israeli military campaign, freedom of the hostages, and security and prosperity, a more stable Gaza. No, this response is equivalent to what the Israelis, almost what the Israelis have said, which is a yes but. And I think Hamas has made it clear that they think it's unrealistic to consider returning the hostages within 72 hours, but they did agree, presumably the Israelis withdraw, to return all the hostages living or dead.
Yeah.
They will not accept disarmament or decommissioning of their weapons, and I think they talk about any sort of end state for Gaza would require the end of the Israeli occupation.
Yeah.
This is a less forthcoming yes but than the Israelis offer. And from now the next move is up to the President Trump.
As we've been speaking, Aaron, we've just received the wires reporting on what Trump is saying. They were already signaling just with posts on social media and what the White House press secretary was saying, framing this as a Hamas acceptance of the Trump peace proposal. Trump is now saying, based on the statement issued by Hamas, I believe they are ready for a lasting peace. Israel must immediately stop its bombing of Gaza. We are already in discussions on details to be worked out. Those are just the rapid fire bulletins coming from the wire services as we speak. So those words, What do you take away from those?
Whether the president understands that he is on the cusp of a negotiation, not on the cusp of a end of the war, is unclear to me. Mm. But what is clear is that the White House has decided that they're not prepared to hang a close for the season sign on the president's initiative. And it is it conceivable, I pose that as a question because we don't know the answer, that in effect, Hamas could agree to release all of the hostages, living or dead, and they have certain requirements about the process by which this has to occur, in exchange for the end to Israeli military activity. Because that's what Trump seems to be setting up, a sort of quid pro quo. He basically says that Hamas has accepted his proposal. No, they haven't. Man, it's not even close. But what Hamas may have been willing to accept, and this is going to usher in a significant moment in the U.S.-Israeli relationship, if what Hamas is saying is that we will release all of the hostages, forget all the other pieces of the proposal, if the Israelis end the war and withdraw either from Gaza or to a perimeter that is yet to be negotiated and is referred to in the Trump plan, then you're setting up a partial implementation of the president's plan. But I frankly, if Trump could get that deal, freeing the hostages, alive and dead, ending the major portion of Israeli military activities, which would be a huge relief to the Palestinian civilian population, and of course, dispensing humanitarian assistance on a predictable and regular basis where people would be given access to proper sanitation, potable water, enough food and shelter. That's partial implementation. That would be a success by anybody's standard. But if Trump believes that Hamas's statement is we're going to end the war, demilitarize, decommission, accept your amnesty out of Gaza, I think he's not thinking clearly or not reading this correctly.
I hear the incredulousness in your voice, certainly the skepticism. What would you need to see and hear throughout, you know, over the next few days, the weekend, to give you a better sense of whether this is actually going to be closer to success this time?
You'd have to see an Israeli-U.S. agreement that essentially suggests that what you can get out of this is what I described, mm-hmm. which is you free all the hostages, the Israelis end the war and withdraw from the 70 or 80% of Gaza that they occupy to a perimeter. That's the best you're going to get out of this, given what I think Hamas's statement suggests. They're not interested decommissioning, demilitarizing. They're not interested in even discussing the future of Gaza outside of what an earlier statement referred to as a Palestinian national consensus. What they might trade are the hostages for an end of the war and an Israeli withdrawal from most of what the Israelis now occupy. Whether Israel and or Trump is prepared to agree to that is another matter. But I think the next step, if Trump has said this is a yes to his proposal, then the next step here is, well, Mr. Prime Minister, they now agreed. So, and I think the statement you read to me, Neil, suggests that the Israelis should now stop fighting and all the hostages are going to be released. It's a fascinating, if that's what Trump is trying to do, then you're probably in for a significant period of tension in the U.S.-Israeli relationship.
Aaron David Miller, we have to leave it there, but there will be more discussions to come, certainly more coverage. I appreciate this, Aaron. Thank you.
And I do as well.
Thanks, Aaron. You too.
Aaron David Miller is a former U.S. State Department Middle East negotiator and is currently a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. We reached him earlier today on the road near Moreland Hills, Ohio. For the first time in over 1,000 years, a woman will lead the Church of England. Today, Sarah Mullally was appointed the new Archbishop of Canterbury. She'll succeed Justin Welby, who resigned from his post last year over allegations that he covered up decades of widespread abuse of boys and young men at Christian summer camps. And she will be tasked with uniting a divided Anglican church. In her first address, Archbishop-designate Mullally admitted that her new role would be complex and challenging, but she also hoped it would offer people joy.
I'm told that there will be much talk today about this being a historic moment and a joyous one for many. I share with you in that joy, not for myself, but for a church that listens to the calling of God and says, yes, we will follow you. Some will be asking what it means for a woman to lead the Church of England and to take on the Archbishop of Canterbury's global role in the Anglican Communion. I intend to be a shepherd who enables everyone's ministry and vocation to flourish, whatever the tradition.
Archbishop of Canterbury designate Sarah Mullally. She will legally become the Archbishop at a ceremony in Canterbury Cathedral next year. Reverend Martine O'Born is a vicar in West London and the chair of the organization Watch, which works for equality for women in the Church of England. We reached her in London.
Reverend O'Born, did you think you would see a day like this in your lifetime?
Yes, very much I did. I think the church didn't want to appoint another white man.
You know the Archbishop designate very well. What would you tell people who don't know her about what you think she brings to the church that it might need right now?
Well, I think she is stronger and more courageous than maybe people might think. You know, she's actually quite a small person, but she's a very strong and powerful person, and I think that she will bring wisdom and good leadership, as well as being a very good pastor.
Have you corresponded at all in any way since this was all announced?
Well, not directly, with her sent a message of congratulations. I'm sure she's very busy, but
maybe just a bit.
I mean, it is historic, the first female Archbishop of Canterbury, and it does come with a certain amount of small print, because although the Church of England does allow female priests and bishops, it also does allow clergy and bishops and churches to not accept them and wants them to flourish. So it's a very weird, complicated setup. And what it does mean is that there are, for example, 7 of her serving bishops who will not receive communion from her, and there is one who does not believe that she should have authority over men. So we are still wrestling with a lot of institutionalized discrimination.
How do you think she will navigate all of that? Do you think an attempt to try to change those minds?
I think she's very sympathetic and would like to see equality for women in the church, but the trouble is that she holds this position on the understanding that she will preserve the status quo. We have come a long way after really centuries of women, you know, being called to take a leadership role in the church but being denied that. I mean, we have now had 30 years of female priests, we've had 10 years of female bishops. It will make a difference having a female Archbishop of Canterbury. Not least, it makes it harder to cover up all this small print.
One of the other issues, as you well know, that the Anglican Church is dealing with is gay marriage. The Archbishop designate helped, you know, lead the charge to support the blessing of same-sex couples, but still supports the church's teaching that marriage is between a man and a woman. And she has said that this is a kind of issue that, quote, may not be resolved quickly. How do you think she will work to try to resolve these kinds of questions that people in the church are wrestling with?
I think she's been fairly clear that she does personally support the blessing of same-sex relationships by clergy if they want to do that. And that's as far as we've got. I see probably her presiding over a little bit of a pause on this at the moment. She's only going to have a tenure of about 6 years because you have to retire at 70. I would be surprised to see her push forward and take a lead to actually get us as far as gay marriage being allowed in the church, because there's a lot of opposition to that by some very powerful factions.
As our listeners have heard and may remember, this is coming after the cover-up allegations. The allegations of widespread abuse in the church. You mentioned at the outset of our conversation part of the reason you think she might have been named, the interest in not appointing a white man again. But in terms of those allegations, where do you think this choice fits into that?
Well, I think it's a good choice because I think that she will make safeguarding a priority. And I think she's in a good position to do that. There are people who say that there's one particular case about 5 years ago that was not handled that well under her watch as Bishop of London. But I would say, on the whole, she has a good and clean record, and I think that she'll make this a priority. And so on the safeguarding front, I think it's a good decision.
We were looking at your social media posts reacting to this news, and usually I don't read the comments, and there were certainly many negative ones touching on the issues we've talked about. But your post, you shared that your daughter, who's 21, joked that, well, now she can't be the first woman to become Archbishop of Canterbury. What do you think this means?
I'm not going to bother to go into the church now because I wanted to be the first female Archbishop of Canterbury. So I think I'll have to find something else to do. But no, she is joking. In fact, yes. I spoke to two of my daughters today, my oldest and my youngest. And the oldest, who has also met Bishop Sarah, was absolutely delighted because anyone who meets her and knows her will know that she is a very kind and very personable woman, and without being, but still with strong opinions that she's not afraid to communicate. I am picking up a very, very warm welcome from everyone.
Reverend Oborne, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
It's a pleasure.
Reverend Martine Oborne is a vicar in West London. His graceful form floated with quiet dignity upon the rippling Stratford-upon-Avon, England, his webbed feet stirring the water, and Reggie himself stirring the hearts of onlookers. When Reggie, a solitary, elegant black swan, appeared among the mute swans around Shakespeare's town late last year, people were delighted. But alas, their delight was not to persist for long, because the hauntingly majestic Reggie turned out to be, in the words of Shakespeare, a bawling, blasphemous, incharitable dog. He earned an ominous nickname, Mr. Terminator, and on Tuesday, Mr. Terminator was evicted. Cyril Bennis is Stratford-upon-Avon's volunteer swan warden, and that's where we reached him.
Cyril, an eviction of a swan, I can only imagine, is not an easy task. How does one go about that?
It was not cooperating, and it was not being impressed by the fact that I was trying to coax it over. Yeah. And obviously you've got to be very careful with you're attempting to catch these black swans, because it was my first time ever. It's my, you know, I normally look after mute swans, and this particular fella was not impressed with life, but I managed to get it out of the water, and it fought like tooth and nail, and it's such a strong bird. Eventually managed to calm it down, get it a bit of talking to, and say, buddy, you know, I'm bigger than you, and got him into the bag, and listen, it was not Yeah. I still am a little bit sore today my little episode.
So it'll take some recovery for you. How are are people reacting to what you had to do?
It's been loved by everyone, by our visitors and by our residents. And as you know, we're a loving nation of wildlife, and it was part of their lives.
So it sounds like you were really torn up about what to do about Reggie. That is his other given name, as you well know. What did you say to people? Yeah.
Damned if you do and damned if you don't. But here's the story. You know, His Majesty King Charles would not be impressed if we had any sort of hanky-wankies, whatever, et cetera, on the river in Stratford-upon-Avon with them mating, which he was trying to mate with the mute swan. And that is not good, and that's not good for the ecology. And that certainly would not go down well with His Majesty.
Yeah, it wasn't just Mr. Terminator, as you've called him, trying to mate with the mute swans. There was some violence, yes?
Violence, yes, trying to drown them, yes.
Oh,
yeah.
No.
And quite horrendous, really. And it's natural. You know, these animals are wild animals, and they're not ornaments as such. And it was sleepless nights in many respects, and not a day would go by that Reggie and would be doing something that would not be the norm within the mute swan community.
Have the mute swans? What's your sense of how they're feeling? What's their behavior?
Oh,
reflecting?
Listen! I've just today and went down. And one of the pairs he separated. Believe you know,
he's trying to break people up or swans up.
he broke up the relationship. Okay, you would not believe it. In my 45 years on the River Avon, this Mr. Reggie Terminator was able to intimidate our mute swans. I mean you would not believe it. I mean our mute swans are pretty big. Broad, they can have their own dark side too. But this beautiful black swan is so versatile. It's got a long neck, and it can hit twice, whereas a mute swan can only. It's like Muhammad Ali; he could hit twice, whereas our mute swan can only hit once, in a sense. And he just looked at our mute swan, and it would just clear off. I could not believe it. And I'm thinking to myself, Cyril, This is not going to happen on my watch. I'm not going to allow this to happen.
And you took action. Where is Reggie now? Where is he going?
I can tell you that Reggie is having a wonderful, wonderful, restful time. He's eating us out of house and home. Reggie is not stupid, you know, and so he's enjoying the hospitality we've given to him here in Stratford-upon-Avon. But I'll tell you for one thing. I'll be glad when we hand over to our friends in Dawlish, who are going to take the swan, where they have a compound of black swans.
Okay.
I'll be glad to see the back end of it going down the motorway to Devon.
You're ready to say goodbye. Will Mr. Terminator be back?
Listen, heavens above, no. He will not. Listen, I've learned my lesson with black swans. I've learned my lesson with the fact that once they come, they're going. And of course, it's very difficult in many respects with social media and with everybody with taking photographs and everybody having to. Somebody just written a poem about him, you know, and of course my name is mentioned because I took it away, you know. So I'll be well known for the man. You, the man that took away the black swan. I'll just have to grin and bear it.
Yeah,
I suppose.
It's the burden you bear for the important work you've been doing, Cyril.
But listen. People are magnificent, really, but they've been upset. There's no doubt about it. I mean, went down this morning into town, and it took me about a couple of hours to get where I wanted to go because somebody was going to stop and say, well, you know, what's going on? And, hey, look, you know, our nature is wonderful for people. People love nature, and more so now, and it's wonderful that even our young generation are loving it. And so this evening, our school kids saying, Mr. Bennis, what have you done with the black swan? I'm like, what? So, you know, it's just, you know, but trust me, I'll be glad to see the back end of it.
Cyril, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you.
Not at all. Pleasure.
Cyril Bennis has volunteered as Stratford-upon-Avon's swan warden for 45 years. We reached him in Stratford-upon-Avon. Thank you.
Pourquoi? Pourquoi est-ce qu'il faut que la vie soit si dure? Pourquoi est-ce que j'échoue dans...
From the Quebec version of The Simpsons, that's Homer reflecting on his attempt to build a barbecue. But maybe you speak a different language.
Warum nicht? Warum muss alles im Leben immer so... Axel, durchste unter diese...
Por que a vida tem que ser tão cruel comigo? Why must life be so hard? Why must I fail in every attempt at masonry?
That's Homer speaking Cantonese, German, Japanese, Portuguese, and English. But you got it in every iteration. That kind of tantrum is an international language. And now here are two other creatures speaking an international language. That first bird was a fairy wren. The second, look, I know I don't need to tell you, was a tawny-flanked prinia. Both birds were warning about the presence of a cuckoo, a mean garbage bird that lays its eggs in other birds' nests, and when the eggs hatch, the baby cuckoos shove the other baby birds out of the nest. So when a cuckoo hoodlum is lurking around smoking cigarettes or doing vandalism, other birds have to be on high alert. But here's the thing. The fairy wren we heard was in Australia, and the tawny-flanked prinia was in Zambia. Now let's hear those calls again. That's essentially the same call from two different species 9,000 kilometers apart. And according to a new study, those are only two of 21 different species around the world, in Australia and Africa, Europe and Asia, that issue the same warning call when they see a cuckoo. Not only do all these international birds know how to make that call, despite never having hung out, they all understand the call, no matter the species. And when they hear it, they show up to mob the cuckoo and drive it out of town. Like Homer's Frico, that call is universally comprehensible and relatable. All birds understand that kind of tough talk. And talk is cheaps. Here's Kate Renata with Be Careful. Renata featuring Thundercat with Be Careful.
We are going to take a short break now when we return after days of protest. An activist in Rabat tells us what young Moroccans are fighting for.
And we'll hear from a New Jersey man who's looking to sell his collection of animatronic dinosaurs. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Thank you.
6:35, and you're listening to As It
Happens.
It is 6:35, and you're listening to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your host, the Johnson Family Conglomerate, who always picks a great set of music, so you'll want to check that out from 7 to 10 o'clock. We receive support from the Northland Foundation, working within Northeast Minnesota, offering grants, small business supports, and programs to help people and communities, working toward a future where everyone feels they belong and can thrive. More at northlandfdn.org. And support comes from AW Research Laboratories in Brainerd, reminding private well owners to test their drinking water annually. Common well contaminants such as bacteria, nitrates, and arsenic are odorless, tasteless, and colorless. More information and test kits available at awlab.com. Now we'll take you back to As It Happens.
Today, like every day for the past week, protesters have filled the streets of Morocco. In Rabat, Casablanca, Marrakesh, and other cities across the country, protesters have been expressing their outrage after 8 pregnant women died at a public hospital in Agadir. They're angry about limited access to quality medical care and about corruption, and the government's decision to spend millions in preparation for the 2030 World Cup, and that's only fueled their anger. Many are young, and an anonymous online group that calls itself Gen Z212 has emerged as a driving force of the protests. Miriam Maskar is a member of the Moroccan Association of Human Rights who's been demonstrating. We reached her in Rabat, Morocco.
Miriam, I can hear a little bit of the protests behind you. Just tell us what you're seeing.
Yeah, so I see that hundreds of youths, Moroccan youths, are protesting in front of the parliament. They are saying slogans like Akhnouch Erhal. Akhnouch is the minister,
the prime minister,
the first minister in Morocco.
Mm-hmm.
They say Akhnouch Erhal, like Akhnouch leave. This government is not yours. Why we came to protest? Because we want health, we want education, we want dignity. And they say also, free Kulshi means free everybody, all arrested in this movement from 27 until now.
Mm-hmm.
And of course they say that this state is corrupt.
Corruption and healthcare are two major issues, as you were saying. The death
yes.
of 8 women who were pregnant in a hospital recently was a big reason
yes.
why people are protesting now. What happened to those women? What do you know?
8 women in a public hospital are dead in 1 week. 8 women when they give birth. So this is the direct reason behind this movement.
They feel, so the protesters feel if there was better healthcare and better equipment at these
exactly.
at this hospital yeah. that the women would have lived.
Exactly, yes.
The World Cup is a big part of this. What are protesters there saying about that?
Yeah, they say instead to do stadiums and prepare Africa Cup and World Cup, you can build hospitals and schools. We don't need the World Cup, but we need good health. We need good quality education.
You've been out every night, every day, Mariam. What kind of reaction and response have you seen from police?
We see that police trying to push protesters and beating them and dragging down them, trying to dispatch them.
Are the protests, as you've seen, Mariam, are they peaceful?
Yes. Actually, Saturday, Sunday and Monday, the Generation Z, they keep struggling and protesting peacefully, but the state used the force and repress the protester. But some of protester, we don't know who, they start using violence when they see police using violence too.
Gen Z 212 is an online group, and like in other countries where we've seen youth protests recently, a lot of this, the discussion about what to do and the concerns are happening on social media platforms. But young people in Morocco right now, what is their daily life like? What are the concerns they have about their future?
When they see the situation of education, of health, and there is no job opportunities, of course they start thinking about their future. One day, if they get sick, maybe they will find themselves in the same situation, not able to get good health, or maybe not find good jobs. So that's why they say it's the moment to demand this right.
And the online group, Gen Z 212, who are they?
They are just, most of them, they are students and young employees.
You are a little bit older than these protesters. Why did you want to be on the streets with them every day?
Because as a member of human rights, of course we support all this movement who demands health, education, and creates job opportunities, because this is what we demand every day in association.
Last night, the Prime Minister spoke to Moroccans, to the country, saying he was ready for a, quote, dialogue and discussion within institutions and public spaces, unquote. What did you think of what the Prime Minister said?
To be honest, we don't trust what he said, because if we didn't see something really changed in hospitals, like really to afford all equipment, and of course we will not believe them. And this is what the media said also. This morning I was driving in the car and I was listening to the radio. They were discussing about this, about what the minister said. He didn't say nothing actually. There is just, he's just talking, but we will believe action, not just words, you know?
Do you think that action will come?
We hope so. If the Gen Z continue protesting every day, maybe, and we wish this government do some actions.
Do they have broader support, Maryam, across the country, people who are not from their generation, older people?
Actually, yes, they support them, but some of them, they were against the violence that some young adopt when they fight the police. But in general, yes, because the health and education is their concern too.
Yeah. How much longer do you think these protests will continue?
I think they won't continue protesting until they find the real answer from the government.
Maryam, thank you. Take care.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Maryam Maskar is a human rights activist who's participating in the protests in Rabat, Morocco. That's where we reached her earlier today. In Manchester today, the street outside Heaton Park Hebrew Congregation Synagogue was crowded with umbrellas, shielding mourners from the rain. At a vigil this afternoon, families gathered to pay their respects to the victims of yesterday's violence, in which a driver attacked people with his car and a knife. It happened on Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the Jewish year. 53-year-old Adrian Dolby and 66-year-old Melvin Kravitz were killed. Manchester police say the two men were huddled behind a door in the synagogue, trying to prevent the attacker from entering, and that it was police who shot Mr. Dolby, killing him. During the vigil, Rabbi Daniel Walker recited prayers and called for a moment of silence. Here's what he told reporters about how the community is coping.
The pain is very raw. We are still in the crisis stage. We haven't even entered the recovery stage. But we are strong and we are going to recover. We are going to rebuild, we're going to continue, and we're going to honour the memory those very, very, very good men who lost their lives in this horrible attack.
Yesterday, Rabbi Walker was leading the Yom Kippur service when the attack happened. In an interview with ITV News Today, he described the, quote, brave men who helped him hold the doors as the attacker tried to get inside the synagogue.
So I went into the synagogue, the prayers began, and then probably about, well, I know the time now, half an hour into the prayers, I heard an almighty bang from outside, shouting. Some of the community men came running in, asking us to close the back doors. I ran to the front at that point, and then, yeah, someone was trying to get in, waving a knife. And one of the community members was very badly injured inside the synagogue. He'd come inside the synagogue.
Did you see the attacker yourself?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, when he was trying to get into the synagogue, there was a large number of us who were trying to hold the doors. He was trying to batter his way inside and throwing plant pots, trying to use his knife to get through the door, body slamming the door repeatedly. So quite a number of us were all there holding the doors, and some very brave men, including Adrian, who defended the synagogue with his life. And we know that Malvin, only for the crime of trying to come to synagogue in the morning, was also killed in the gate by the terrorist.
Was the attacker saying anything to you at the time?
He, yes, I'm going to get you. He was shouting, threats, thing, I'm going to get you, I'm coming in, things like that.
These are obviously difficult things for you to recount.
Sure.
I'm guessing what he was saying was particularly disturbing.
Well, yeah, he was trying to get in at the time, yeah.
That was Rabbi Daniel Walker from Heaton Park Hebrew Congregation Synagogue talking to Paul Brand from ITV News in the UK. If you take a virtual stroll through Facebook Marketplace, you'll find a vast assortment of things that you absolutely do not need. Coffee mugs that look like Santa, a jumbled mess of Hot Wheels tracks, a bucket of used tennis balls. But then there are things you don't need, strictly speaking, but on second thought, maybe you definitely do. Take, for example, a listing in Leonia, New Jersey, a Velociraptor, priced at $700 US, or for a little over $2,000, a Stegosaurus, and the list goes on. All dinosaurs, all animatronic. Guy Gazelle is the man behind those posts. After more than a decade, his outdoor theme park, Field Station Dinosaurs, is closing its doors next month, and so the dinosaurs need a new home. We reached Mr. Gazelle in Leonia, New Jersey.
Guy, our listeners just heard a couple of the price tags for some of the dinosaurs you have on hand. What if they really, you know, they have some yard space and they love a T-Rex? What would that cost them?
So it will cost them more to move the dinosaur than to buy the dinosaur if they buy the T-Rex. And right now, if somebody just wants a dinosaur for their backyard, well, they'd have to buy them all, because right now we are working with museums and zoos and other attractions, and we're trying to keep the collection together. Okay. We're looking at somebody who wants to buy all the dinosaurs.
Okay, you're not separating this family.
Not yet, but you know, we will if that's what it comes to.
Okay, how much? Just curious, would it cost to move a T-Rex? like the one you have?
Whatever the distance is that it takes to move a shipping container.
Understood.
Because the dinosaurs all fit into shipping containers when they come apart. So shipping to someplace that's fairly close by, you know, it's not very expensive to ship a shipping container. But we've gotten calls from France and Ireland. They're going to have to put it on a ship.
Yeah, so I would imagine. Yes. When do you expect to make a decision?
So we actually are opening the show tonight here at the field station. We've been just swamped, so busy. I would say by next Friday, if the buyers are serious, we could make a decision by the end of next week.
So for you, you know, more than a decade, 13 years of doing this, you must love the characters, these dinosaurs that you're now giving up. Is it hard to let go of them?
It is. It's a little like putting your pet up for adoption. It's something I've grown so fond of them. They have personalities to me now. I sort of know their quirks and their little picadillos. I kind of know them all, and it's sad to say goodbye to them. I want to find the best home possible.
And in terms of those quirks, do you have an example?
Oh yeah, some of them. Their voice has changed over the years because we've changed the file, and I wasn't paying attention, and somebody put a new file in, and suddenly it's like a stranger in the park. And also, I've learned because I've spent a lot of time fixing the dinosaurs and maintaining the dinosaurs. I kind of know what's going to break in each one, and I've learned a lot about. We call ourselves the dinosaur vets, and I've learned a lot about dinosaur vets medicine.
Right. For animatronic dinosaurs, obviously.
For animatronic dinosaurs, yes.
So do they roar and talk when you say their voices?
So all of them roar because the sound is a separate system. And at the beginning of every season, they all move. And then during the course of the season, if I don't have time to get over to fix something that has broken, they lose some level of motion during the year. We try to keep up. We try to get the repairs done. But by the end of every season, they all have lost some level of motion. And then we fix them up before the next year and we do it all over again. Mm.
The visitors, obviously, and the children that have been coming to the park love these dinosaurs, I'm sure. But the wildlife around there, when things are shut down, what kinds of things do they get up to?
Yeah, unfortunately, the wildlife loves the dinosaurs. The birds love, the dinosaurs are made out of foam, and the birds love that foam to build their nests. So every morning we come in, we have to scout out to see which dinosaurs the birds have decided to peck away at and take the foam to build their nests. And raccoons, they don't have to take the foam away to build their nest. They go ahead and they build their nest right in the dinosaurs. They'll make a little hole that we don't notice. They'll climb in. They'll make a nest. We had one time here at the field station, while we were open and guests were looking at the Triceratops, a little head popped out from the Triceratops back, and then a mama raccoon crawled out, and then the baby raccoons crawled out, and they all followed her as she walked the entire length of the dinosaur to the end of the tail and hopped off and walked into the woods. So we put up with it. If we have to fix a dinosaur, it's okay.
Sure, you're dinosaur vets, as we've already established, expert dinosaur vets. Was this kind of field, or dinosaurs in particular, something that came to you later in life, or have you always loved dinosaurs?
So my really earliest memory is dinosaurs. I went as a tiny little kid to the New York World's Fair in 1965, and I remember vividly the famous Sinclair dinosaurs that were on display there. So the dinosaur has always been something, just like any little kid. I kept on it, though, as a grown-up. And then I was in the theater, and then I was in the exhibit business. And what I've done is I've put my experience in the theater, my experience as an exhibit producer, and my love of dinosaurs all together into one thing. It's like I lived my whole life to get to this.
What do you love about them so much?
I think I like what everyone likes about dinosaurs, which is that they are real. They were real. And I love that they lived here. Yeah, they lived right where we are. Because kids have a shaky sense of time. You know, it's like, well, they lived a long time ago. It doesn't really mean much to a kid. Mm-hmm. Everything is a long time ago to a kid. But when you say the dinosaurs lived right here, they understand it. And they feel very close to dinosaurs because of that.
Guy, thank you for this.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Guy Gazelle is the director of the theme park Field Station Dinosaurs. We reached him in Leonia, New Jersey. Their goal is to raise money to help eradicate polio once and for all. But 72-year-old Peter Tehan and 89-year-old Ed Galkin aren't doing that by getting people to sponsor a fun run or something. They're doing it by flying a single-engine plane around the Atlantic. They started in New Jersey at the end of August, and they landed in St. John's yesterday by way of Iceland, Denmark, Norway, Poland, the UK, France, Spain, and Portugal. They told CBC St. John's host Jen White about the journey and the records they just happened to set while doing it. The first voice you'll hear is Mr. Galkin's.
I was very motivated by what Peter did 2 or 3 years ago, raising over $2 million for Rotary eradicating polio.
Wow.
So I called about 6 months ago and said, you know, you just flew around the world. I flew around the world before. I said, I just don't want to do that with what's going on right now. But how about doing a circle the Atlantic and doing it in my plane? And he said, when do we leave? So we left the 30th of August, and we'll be back the 5th of October.
I want to talk about the journey, too. So you're in a single-engine plane. I imagine it's a pretty tight quarters in there.
Yes.
What was it like traveling for the both of you?
Well, you're elbow to elbow, shoulder to shoulder, hip to hip, and you can't get up and can't move around. So when you're 10 hours in that position, going over, we were 9 hours from Goose Bay over to Iceland, it gets a little tight, a little cold, cramped in there. It's more the excitement of where you're going and what you've experienced and the wonderful way the world's treated us as we made this awareness.
And Ed, you're now likely the oldest person to fly across the Atlantic in a single-engine plane. How does it feel?
It feels really wonderful to set a record. Yeah, Peter decided that since we're flying the Atlantic, why don't we set a couple of records? So, Peter, you could explain more about the Guinness's record that I'm trying to accomplish.
Well, with Guinness World Records, where he's qualified now, we have to do all the documentation. But to be the oldest pilot to fly across the Atlantic, both eastbound and westbound. And yesterday we did a speed record from Azores here to St. John.
Really?
That's going to go into the international records. That's through the Federation of Aeronautic International. Mm-hmm. So we'll end up with 3 international records in aviation.
Ed Galkin and Peter Tehan talking to Jen White, host of the St. John's Morning Show.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.
This is 91.7.